So this is the third seminar on the historiography of the First World War. And I've finished looking at the general questions of history and about military and diplomatic history, which continues today, but which was specially dominant before the 1960s. So now we're going to move on to social history. And I asked you last week what social history was, you were saying that it's about people as groups, social classes, women and men, working class people, immigrants or not immigrants, black and white. All that is the kind of things we associate with social history. But of course, also all history is social from one point of view, the trend towards social history changes the sources, the questions, and the methods used in writing history. The sources, well, you would expect more sources around organizations, maybe political parties, trade unions, expressions of mass opinion like newspapers. In Britain, there's a long tradition of newspapers having letters pages, readers' letters. And these are tremendously rich as sources. So that kind of thing. Now, why? Why did social history rise in the 1960s? Well, I already looked at one other aspect of the changes in historiography, and I was saying that in military history they talk more and more about ordinary soldiers. It's considered to be important, the experience of the ordinary person, and I interpret this as a rise in the democratic spirit over the decades. Remember, universal suffrage in Britain comes in 1929, universal suffrage for men 1918, at the end of the war. And universal suffrage with equal conditions for men and women in 1929. But maybe it takes time for this idea that, you know, ordinary people deserve listening to go through. And certainly also the historical establishment changed. In 1920, if you wanted to go to university and to become a historian, if you weren't born into a rich family, it's really extremely difficult. Remember, in 1900, there are only 20,000 university students in Britain, in 1900, most of them in Oxford and Cambridge. However, in the 1960s, for completely other reasons, there are more and more universities. There are more and more universities because the economy is getting more sophisticated. The new chemicals industries and car industries and so on, they need people who do more studies. And so for the first time, ordinary people can go to university, and here you are. Okay, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Did your grandmother go to university?
No.
It was an impossible idea, was it, for your grandmother, for my grandmother? Yes, it's an incredible idea. So that was a big change. Now, this affected history, accidentally. This meant more history departments, many more historians, and some of these historians just from ordinary families, not from elite families. And so it's not surprising that that helped them to be interested in the lives of ordinary people. And in social history. The other thing is that this is a time when, especially after 68, Marxist ideas are very influential in the universities. Yeah? And of course, Marxist ideas in the widest sense are about saying the people who are important are the people who make the tables and the floors and the buildings and the everything around you, and therefore it's not surprising to see in those circumstances a rise in social history. How does that show in the books that are produced or that have been produced? Well, first of all, you get general views about, such as this one. This is an oral history book, so based on interviews of old people, we looked at the advantages and the disadvantages of that. People might have a bad memory or not be so honest. But yeah, all quite on the home front, an oral history of life in Britain during the First World War. So this is a completely different question. It's not, you know, why did the British win or what tactics did they use in the army. It's what was life like for ordinary people, because of course life was transformed, in particular for women. Women were involved in doing jobs they'd never done before. And the reactions were rather mixed. I remember reading, it may have been in here, about a woman whose father had gone to war, and they were butchers. And at the time, of course, nobody has a fridge, so you deliver meat every day to the middle-class houses, the working-class people, on Sundays. So every day the butcher knocks on the door and said, "What would you like to buy today?" Because you can't keep the meat for much longer. So this woman took over from her father and delivered the meat, and quite a number of customers, men and women, refused to buy meat from her because she was a woman. So there were quite rigid ideas about what women should and shouldn't do, not because it was meat, because she was going door to door. That was not respectable, to go door to door. Anything could happen. Yeah, okay, that's the idea. Some general works on the home front. However, there's something notable about this. So it's about society, about ordinary people. But nevertheless, the home front, the ordinary people are defined, their lives are defined by the war. That is to say, on dit en français, sur le front intérieur. So there's an element of military truth in this. If you want to win a modern 20th century war, it's a total war, and the whole population must be mobilized to have the maximum number of people in the factories and in the fields in order to produce more uniforms and guns and bombs than the other country. Yeah. That's how the First World War works. But nevertheless, the home front, in some ways this can be a little bit misleading, the home front, because of course people thought about the war a lot, but they didn't think about the war all the time, because they continued doing what people do, like continued with life. Also, although the war, of course, was very dangerous, most people were used to people dying. Their children died frequently. It was very rare to have all your children grow up. There were lots of accidents because in factories and building sites, because there was not the same safety conditions as today. So although, of course, the war was a terrible thing, in some ways it was more traumatic for the middle classes who had comfortable lives, because ordinary people's lives were really pretty hard. And so there's that. In my own speciality, which as you know is popular song, I noticed this because only one, less than a third of the songs talk about the war in any way at all. So two-thirds of the songs say nothing about the war or life in wartime, etc. There's obviously, life goes on. Of course, it does as it have to. More home front. How Britain survived the Great War. There you can see photographs there. So there you have at the top a photograph of women carrying. I think they're working in agriculture and carrying something. And so, of course, the idea is supposed to be that there are women doing things that women don't normally do. What are the women doing there that they don't normally do? Yeah, they're wearing trousers. Now that is really a big thing in the First World War. In the Second World War, it was not so shocking. In the First World War, they're wearing trousers. The differences between men and women's habits and costumes were much more rigid than today. One of the results of this is that in the music hall, in the entertainment, it was quite common to have women dressed as men, pretending to be men and singing songs. And this genre of... Hello. This genre of male impersonation on the stage disappeared almost completely in the 1920s. And one of the reasons it was so popular in the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s is because there was something... As soon as you put a woman on stage dressed as a man, it was tremendously... Everybody thought that was extremely funny. Extremely funny. And of course, it's only extremely funny if society has very strict rules. Otherwise, it's not funny anymore. It's like today, if you have a woman on stage and she's wearing trousers, well, she needs to do something else to interest the audience. That's not enough. Yeah. So what are you doing today? Well, I'm wearing trousers. It's not good enough. Yeah. So big transformations in women's lives, and people argued about them all the time. Somebody says, "Oh, well, this is good. Women can do stuff, you see." And other people says, "No, it's bad because that's not natural to women." And other people say, "Oh, well, don't worry, it will all change back when the war is finished." "Oh, I'm worried. I don't know if it will all change back when the war is finished." Yeah. All this goes on. One of the most popular themes of popular songs is the new roles of women. And what is fascinating about them is that most of the songs are not saying, it's super, women have new roles. And most of the songs are not saying, it's terrible, women have new roles. Most of the songs say, it's worrying. It's worrying. That's important because that means that the song can talk to the people who think it's a good thing, the people who think it's a bad thing, and the very large number of people who are not sure. How Britain survived the Great War there, the home front of the Great War. Again, we have women there. I'm not sure what the women are doing there. What are they doing in the middle picture? Oh, they might. Yeah, they're building a plane. I think you're right. They must be building a plane. And at the top, of course, they're looking after soldiers, they're nurses. Tremendous number of books written about nurses in the First World War. Of course, there were a lot of nurses. People's lives were very much transformed by that. Very often, it was middle-class women who became nurses because they were often not paid, and so only middle-class women could do it. These are the home fronts. Blighty, British society in the era of the Great War. Blighty is an affectionate name for Britain. It comes from an Indian word. It's from the colonialists in India who adapted a word from some Indian language, I'm not sure which one, Blighty, and that's home. Home sweet home. A few books about workers. There you have The Workers' War, British Industry in the First World War. These are both from this year, 2014. Great War Railwaymen, Britain's Railway Company Workers at War. There's Jeremy Higgins and Anthony Burton. I wrote that it's 2014 because this area of workers at war is still, there's still plenty of kinds of workers who have not been studied. Shop workers or insurance workers and so on. And there's all sorts of interesting questions there. I mean, one of the questions is about trade unions. I'll come to it in a moment. But for example, more and more women were working in the factories. And some of the trade unions said, oh, well, we don't want women members. And so they weren't allowed to join. And other trade unions said, oh, what we need is a full-time organiser whose job is to recruit women. Yeah, so inside the trade unions, you had probably, you had a large amount of resistance among male trade unionists to women joining the trade unions, but not everywhere. In some trade unions were exceptionally enthusiastic about recruiting women. So all those kinds of questions came up. So still in 2014, they're finding new aspects of this. Now, one kind of more or less social history, I count it as social history, which is tremendously popular, is local history. This can be written by university people, but also very often by amateurs or by local voluntary organisations, or as you say in French, association. I have my little campaign to stop French people saying in English association to mean association because it's not correct. So, for example, here's a book, Bradford in the Great War. And notice what's interesting about it is not just that it's been written about one town, so you can sell it to people who are proud of their town. Yeah, it's partly about the market, yeah, people who are proud of their town. Whereas, you know, just like the railway workers book, you can sell it to railway workers, there's a lot of them. But also, it's that we don't just have the name there of the editors, but also Bradford World War I Group. That is to say, an organisation of amateurs who get together because they want to work on this particular history. Very specific to the First World War. You can find local groups working on local history from the past, from other periods, but the First World War is the favourite period for people to work at. Dover and Folkestone during the Great War.
Folkestone was a port or something?
Say again?
Folkestone. What was it?
It's a town.
Yes, I know about Fortunlin, which was the channel.
Yes.
What was it?
I think it's kind of a holiday place, isn't it? But I'm not sure. I don't think I've ever been there. This is the case of Newmarket, which is a small town in East Anglia. And this is just to say something about historical writings today. Of course, you can see that they have a website. Rather than publishing a book, they have a website. They might get more people to read it that way. It can be the case today. I know that the history which I write, more of it is read on the web than is read on paper. Not the books, because the book people don't read a book on site, but articles people will read online more. Hove and the Great War, another seaside town. So this is part both of history writing and also of kind of commemoration and local history, because when you're writing local history to sell to people from your local town because they like their local town or feel attached to it, then you're somewhere between history and commemoration. But then probably that line cannot be drawn between history and commemoration. Now, certainly once the dominant tendency moved away from military history and diplomatic history, because as you understand, in 1940 to 1918, military history and diplomatic history was all about men. There were no women diplomats in 1940. There may have been one, but there weren't many. So social history, also because it was born in the 1960s, which is the time of the women's movement, when people are saying, yeah, hey, we need to talk about women, their importance. Social history about women has been one of the more active areas, and so there's plenty of books about this. Women Workers in the First World War by Gail Braben. Gail Braben, Routledge Library Editions on Women's History. Oh, there it is again. Lynn MacDonald's book, which is about nurses. And nurses are probably the most studied of the groups of women in the First World War. The Roses of No Man's Land, the title is taken from a song, The Rose of No Man's Land, because where he sings about, you know, how life is very hard in the war, but at least you have these lovely women nurses. Of course, he has to, the songs about nurses are very chaste, because nurses were under a lot of pressure not to be in any way seductive. And the rules for nurses working in France in the military hospitals were extremely strict. Yeah, if you used the first name of a patient, you were in big trouble. Yeah, so they thought all that side of it. Rose of No Man's Land there. This is a biography, Elsie and Mary Go to War, and it's about two ambulance drivers. It's about two women from elite families who just decided they wanted to help the war, and they wanted to join the ambulance drivers, and they had to fight to do it. In fact, if I remember correctly, the English Red Cross did not want any women, and so they had to go to Belgium, and the Belgians were more flexible. There was a lot of patriotic women wanted to help the war drive, but at the beginning of the war they were often refused. In fact, there's a famous case of a woman doctor going to ask some responsible, some high-up person in the war officer, what can I do to help the war? And apparently he said, please, lady, go home and sit still. Yeah. So you know, very heavy and insulting way that women could be treated at the time. I already mentioned this one, which is a diary. This is a diary of an elite woman who stays at home, who is very enthusiastic about the war. So very, very interesting how she writes about it. And this one, Angela Walcott, Munitions Workers in the Great War. If you're going to look at social history, you're obliged not just to look at groups of people, but at the organisations which they form. Social history for other centuries has always concentrated on the socialist movement, religious movements, political organisations and so on. And this has been somewhat less studied in the First World War. Partly because the political parties, the big political parties, didn't really fight with each other anymore during the war. They sort of stopped it for the time being. But there have been some books about organisations. A 1930 book, The Church of England and the First World War, absolutely fascinating piece of work, which has been updated recently, about 10 years ago, with two more books about that, which brings up all sorts of interesting questions. It was quite a good idea from the purely material point of view. It was quite a good idea to be a priest, that you weren't as likely to be killed. And the other interesting thing is that the Catholic priests got killed more than the Anglican priests. Very simple reason. Two reasons, actually. First of all, the Catholic priests were working class, and the Anglican priests were from elite families. That's just because the Catholic populations, Irish, were poor, and their priests were also from poor families. But it's also that the Catholics had the habit of taking communion out, and they had to give the last rites. It's a sacrament in Catholic religion. There is a special sacrament for dying people. And so the Catholic priests were out there with the dying, whereas the Anglicans had nothing specific to say to dying people, and so they didn't have to go into such dangerous situations. Now, this is the religious side of it. This monograph is the Party of Patriotism, the Conservative Party in the First World War, but still seem, I think there's still quite a lot of space for new books in the social history. Labour's Great War. Now, that's an interesting example that I took there, Labour's Great War, because it's as you can tell from the spelling, that's American. That's about American trade unions. And the reason I chose a book about American trade unions is because there are very, 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 very few books about British trade unions during the First World War. There is this one, which is a comparison between Britain and France, Labour at War by John Horne. And that's about it. So this is fascinating because there are millions of new trade unionists join the war. Millions of new trade unionists. The trade unions rich very, very quickly. And in 1916, 1917, 1918, there are very big strikes in Britain. And yet no historians have decided to... almost no historians have decided to look at trade unions during the war. And in fact, to such an extent that if you take the British Library catalogue, can you see what I have searched for? Yep, First World War trade unions I've searched for. And first of all, I have zero response, no answers. But also, what does the software say? Trenches. Yeah. Did you mean First World War trenches? So this is how I discovered, I thought that was funny, this is how I discovered that nobody is writing about trade unions in the First World War. And this brings us to ask why not. Difficult question, but I do have some ideas. What is it that's making historians not want to for 50 years, you know? Well, I don't know, but I think it's probable that, remember that during the First World War, the majority of trade unions supported the war. And even though most trade unions before the war and most trade unions today consider the war to be a terrible thing for workers killing workers, yeah? So the general trade union movement is against the First World War, but during the actual First World War, the trade unions were in favour of it. Now, it may be, I can't prove this, but it may be that historians who work on the trade unions, normally they are people who like the trade unions, who think they're very good and positive things, and maybe they don't want to look too much at this period when the trade unions were really working very hard to go and kill people from another nation. I suspect that that the people who are interested in this period are not the people who are specialising in trade unions, I suspect. Now, this may be the book I need to write, the First World War trade unions, British trade unions during the First World War. There's not absolutely nothing, but there are more books on nurses than on trade unions. Now, I have nothing against nurses, but you know, there were a lot more people in trade unions than there were nurses. So that's very, very notable absence there. Now, absence is a I'm guessing at the explanation, but absences are always a little difficult to explain. Other social aspects of the Great War, because it has to be said that sometime in the 1970s, according to Eric Hobsbawm, who's one of the great British historians, he said that social history was transformed. Social history was transformed and became the history of society. Now, history of society is wider than social history, and so here are a couple of examples, some of them very old. This one by Magnus Hirschfeld is from the 1930s, The Sexual History of the World War. Now, it has to be said it's a bit of a maverick publication. But probably, I think there's probably time for another book on that, because it could be very, very interesting, I would think. Now, this has some interesting things, but it's a rather... it's a bit hard to describe, really. It's not, strictly speaking, a serious history book, although it does have a lot of information in it, Magnus Hirschfeld. The British working class and enthusiasm for war. Yeah, how enthusiastic were the British working class in 1914? In the first two years of war, then while the volunteering went on. Quite a complex story there. It depended partly from region to region. It was much easier to recruit people in the east of England than in Wales. Very difficult to recruit people, to recruit Catholics in Ireland. But not so difficult to recruit Protestants in Northern Ireland. Yes, and it's always a very, very complex thing. But certainly the official national myth of a generally enthusiastic population is not correct. And here a recent example, actually, Rachel Duffett, The Stomach for Fighting, Food and the Soldiers of the Great War. So they're not taking a particular social group, but taking a particular activity, eating, which is, as you know, quite interesting and important. Notice that this is absolutely not a recipe book. Yeah, it's not an anecdotal thing. It's a very serious study of how did they feed the soldiers, and also what did the soldiers think about how they were fed, what was important to them. One of my friends recently wrote an article about tobacco and the First World War. The attitude to tobacco was not the same as today. So in Christmas 1914, every soldier in the British Army received a little box with tobacco. It says, with thanks from Princess Mary or Queen... Princess Mary, I think, yes. And so from the royal family, a present for Christmas, tobacco. And they gave free tobacco to a lot of soldiers. That was a very generalised idea. I don't think they'd do this today. Even if you're going to be shot, you're not allowed to smoke. It's not good for your health. There's also a very famous priest from the First World War, and he was tremendously well known among the soldiers. And he had a nickname which was Woodbine Willie. Woodbine is a particular cigarette, and he used to give. In fact, one of the things the priest did very much was to give cigarettes to soldiers. It was kind of a currency. And I think you can kind of understand that if you're... I don't know if any of you have ever been smokers, but if you're going to be bored and in danger for months on end, you know, smoking is one way of surviving. But this is about food. And they're finally healing the nation's soldiers and the culture of caregiving. Looking after soldiers, again, nurses and other people. But here we get to a little complication. Yes, so this is the period of social and we're going to move on to cultural history in a moment. It has to be said that France was rather influential in this period of social history, that this in France there is the Le Mouvement Social, which is a journal of the time, and the in America there was also a movement towards labor history. So that's all I have to say really about social history, and I think it's probably important to notice that the move towards social history applied to the study of every century. So the 18th century, the 17th century, the 19th century, all of those historians moved more towards social history and less towards the history of kings and battles. However, for the First World War, probably less social history than in other centuries. But First World War historians are rather bizarre in another way. I don't know if I mentioned to this last year, but usually historians are medievalists or 19th-century specialists. First World War, it's only 4.5 years. So it's very, very unusual. Normally, you're a specialist historian. You specialize in the 19th century. And for rather strange reasons, historians believe that the 19th century began in 1789 and finished in 1914. Because, of course, 100 years is not a very clear remark. Whereas from the French Revolution to the First World War, it's got more coherence. But First World War historians are always concentrating on just 4.5 years, and this can be a danger because sometimes historians can miss the continuities with before the war or the continuities with after the war. Yeah, and so it's a bit of a danger. In some ways, it shouldn't really exist, First World War specialists, because it's such a very, very short thing, you know, it's like being, but we'll come back to that. So, let's move on. I'll come back to that in a moment. We've got the third field, cultural history. And so, this is the time when I get to ask you a question. What do you imagine cultural history is? Yes. Now, if I ask you, what do you think cultural history is, you have to give an answer which does not include the word culture or cultural. Yeah, that's right. You see the problem, yeah, because otherwise we'll go around in circles. It's very, it is very difficult, but... you're not allowed to use that word. Yeah, okay, so you should understand humans. Okay, now, understanding humans, I think that's something that people are always trying to do. Certainly historians are trying to understand humans. Psychologists are also trying to understand humans. Sociologists are also trying to understand humans. So what is this culture, then? What's culture? Oh, right, okay, so we're definitely getting there, because understanding human practices, we're getting closer here, yeah? So it's true that we expect culture, in the sense of cultural history, to talk about practices. That is, not things which individuals occasionally do, but things that large groups of people generally do. Yeah. Because, of course, you know, everybody knows one person who is... who likes building houses out of iPhones, but you can't understand history from that person, because it's just an individual doing something bizarre. Culture is certainly about generalized human practices. That's one thing. Yeah. Any more about culture? Cultural history. Okay, so changing, yeah? Okay, so changing generalized human practices, yeah, because that's the fashion side of it, that's certainly part of it. Yes, I mean, of course, culture has always had slightly two meanings in intellectual circles. One is artistic production of recognized worth. You know, what you find in the Louvre and in the Conservatoire, and, you know, culture. Generally, if you say in English, she's very cultured, that means, you know, she knows the difference between Bach and Beethoven, and you know, she goes to, you know, high prestigious cultural activities. And then the other meaning, which is more a sort of psychologist meaning, that anything which is not natural is cultural, as in nature and culture. So, and in cultural history, we're somewhere between that. And certainly, we're looking for understanding human practices. And in fact, we already had some. Although I put them into the section on social history, if you actually look at the top of this book, you can see cultural history of modern war at the top. That is to say that the name of the series is Cultural History of Modern War. Other publishing houses have series of books called Social and Cultural History. And that's because drawing the exact line between social and culture is not easy. But we're going to look at some aspects of this. This is what we call le tournant culturel, the cultural turn. This is not easy to define, but certainly it involves sometimes an ethnographic look at society. That is to say, analysing generalised practices in the way that you would do if you came across an alien society. You know, people who'd been living in the Amazon rainforest and never seen any people from outside. It also is very closely linked to the history of representations. There are many, many kinds of history which have been put forward over the years, and sometimes the lines between them are not clear at all. But, for example, there was a fashion a few decades ago for the history of mentalities, l'histoire des mentalités. And that has kind of lost speed, because the history of representations has risen. And this is quite an interesting point, actually, because the problem with the history of mentalities is that there is a tendency to think, what was the mentality of 1920s France? And one of the difficulties with that vision of the world is it can exaggerate the homogeneity of society. That in reality, in 1920s France, people didn't agree with each other. And so to say what was the mentality of 1920s France is a little bit dangerous. There's a danger of oversimplification. Whereas the idea of the history of representations, how did different groups of people in 1920s France see the First World War? How did they represent their world? Yeah, and so that's been very much a rise. And certainly cultural history has partly been a certain step forward in a recognition of the importance of how people understand what they see. So what is important is not just what happens, but what it means to people. So, for example, if 500 years from now somebody looks back on the 21st century and say, so on the 11th of September 2001, 3,000 people were killed in New York. But in that year, 7,000 people were killed in car accidents in France. Oh, it must be the same. It must have had the same effect. And of course, that's not the case, because the representation to people, but also to politicians, of the attacks of the 11th of September is not the same as the representation of 5,000 people killed in car accidents on the roads. Yeah, and so the representation is fundamental. What goes on there. So why did cultural history rise? Well, that's a big question. But certainly some of the reasons were, firstly, the influence of Marxism was on its way down. Because of political events in the 1980s, the collapse of the Soviet Union, which many people thought of as a Marxist place, and the rise of the new conservatives, Thatcher, Reagan, and also their supporters in the universities. Within the history departments, Marxists were getting less and less influential. And in some ways, cultural history was a way for historians to continue studying ordinary people, without necessarily attacking it from a Marxist point of view. So that's one of the things that was certainly going on at the time. It was a kind of compromise that cultural history allows historians to study ordinary people and their practices, which is now generally accepted to be necessary, but without suggesting any specific political approach. So you can be a cultural historian and very conservative, and you can be a cultural historian and very Marxist. Whereas in social history, that was not so easy. Social history tended to be kind of Marxist, and military history tended to be kind of conservative. So it was very flexible. So it's very, very flexible time. This is also a period when, from the 60s, with 1957, I think, Roland Barthes' Mythologie, a very important book for intellectual studies of all sorts. And one of the things he's said and showed is that ordinary, banal things in everyday life deserve to be studied. So Roland Barthes, for example, studied l'image de la voiture Citroën parmi toute la population. And it doesn't matter so much Citroën, that's not the point. But he said, you know, this is something you can study. What does a car mean to people? And this was a very new idea. So it's kind of a little bit social psychology, a little bit cultural studies. But he's saying, you know, what needs to be studied is not just Beethoven and Bach and so on, but also huge areas of what people do in their everyday lives. This was taken up in Britain by the Birmingham Centre for Cultural Studies, very influential group of people around, what's his name? Well, Stuart Hall was the second guy who took it over, and before that there was another guy whose name I have forgotten, but Stuart Hall and the Birmingham Centre for Cultural Studies really pushed forward this idea: it's okay to study television, to study adverts, to study pop music. There are important things to be said about all these things. Yeah, so all that encouraged then cultural history in general, and so cultural history of the First World War. I just want years to look at it. There you go. Okay, it's finished now. Right. Okay. So, from the point of view of the First World War, the most influential book which helped to launch cultural history was this book, *The Great War and Modern Memory* by Paul Fossel, which is 1975, I think, sometime in the 1970s. Very, very influential book. And why was it influential? I need to read it again. I've forgotten half of what's in it. But he wrote about how the Great War has been represented in novels since the Great War. And so some people would say, well, no, that's a book about, that's about literary criticism. That's not history. You're writing about literary criticism. Go away into the literary department. We don't want you here. But he was saying, no, how the Great War is presented in literature is important, because that's what forms people's views about the Great War. So this is, again, history of representations. Tremendously influential, you know, the winner of the National Book Award. Yes, this is an American gentleman, Paul Fossel. And he also spent a lot of time in this book explaining how fiction and autobiography is not so different. Many soldiers who were writers wrote novels about their experience in the war, and there is a link between the two of them. Now, this whole question of representation is a complicated question, because some some enthusiasts of cultural history go even further, and they say, oh, well, in fact, everything you know about the First World War is only discourses. That's what you call sometimes call this the linguistic turn. So cultural history opens up a whole new load of possibilities, but it also has a small number of people who say, oh, well, you know, really, all history is just the history of discourses. Because you only have a document, you cannot find the truth about the past. That's not my opinion, but it's the opinion of some of the more extreme, if you like, believers in history as culture, that there's only discourse. So let's see what other kinds of things were produced along these lines. This is a fascinating book in French, this one, 14-18 aujourd'hui, La Grande Guerre dans la France contemporaine. I think this is 3 years old. What he does is he takes every chapter is about a different representation of the Great War in the 21st century. So, for example, he finds 15 rock songs from the 21st century which talk about the Great War and says, how is it presented? And novels, films, etc. What is the Great War doing today? And he also studies commemorations as well. The other possibility, but which is much less studied, that is to say, in general, cultural history of the First World War is about the representations, or at least it's very frequently about the representations of the First World War in culture. But this is the exception. This one is about culture during the First World War. So these are, in many ways, these are two different ideas of cultural history. Yeah, the history of cultural activities during the war, or the history of representations of the First World War in culture. There are not so many of these, whereas this is really the category which my own book falls into, La chanson populaire en Angleterre pendant la Grande Guerre, what actually happened during those periods. Here are some other books in the series Cultural History of Modern War. This one by Michael Roper, The Secret Battle, Emotional Survival in the Great War. Now, sometimes cultural history is criticized for attacking questions where sometimes you think it might be too vague. Is it possible to study emotional survival of people 100 years ago? Not easy. But obviously this gentleman thinks you can because he wrote a book about it. And this is in fact based on letters which the soldiers write to their mothers. This is only based on letters which the soldiers wrote to their mothers. So this is an interesting case because there are many, many collections of letters which are published, but very often they are just published. So here are 100 letters. I found 500 letters. I found 100 of them interesting. Here is the book with 100, which is not very scientific. Yeah, that's a kind of an amateur way of dealing with. Which is very, very interesting. But the problem is, why did you choose these 100 and not the other 400? Well, because I thought they were more interesting. That's not good enough for a historian. Yeah. Whereas this is a real historian, so he takes and tries to quantify and analyze the ways that soldiers talk about their mothers. And what conclusion we can draw about the mentality, if you like, or the representation the soldiers have of their mothers. So can be some very interesting stuff in there. Fighting Different Wars, Experience, Memory, and the First World War in Britain. Okay, I don't know a lot about that particular one. A War Imagined, the First World War, and what? English culture. The First World War in English culture, I think. No, again, not quite sure what's going on in there. Now, over the last 15 years, really, one of the most popular themes of cultural history is commemoration. So that's interesting because we talked about history of representations. Now, commemoration is a particular form of representation, because it's a form of representation which involves certain activities to honour participants from the past. And so that involves all sorts of anthropological or socio-psychological effects. So here you have Unionists and Great War commemoration in the north of Ireland, 1914-39. So what did the Unionists do between the two wars to commemorate the First World War? The Unionists, then, of course, the mostly Protestant people from the north of Ireland who defend the Union with the United Kingdom. This is tremendously popular. There are more and more books about commemoration. Here's another one. War, Memory, and Popular Culture. Essays on Modes of Remembrance and Commemoration. So Modes of Remembrance and Commemoration. You have Memory, Remembrance, Commemoration. Here you have then an attempt to analyse what does it mean to remember the war? What does it mean to commemorate the war? What does it mean to honour the people who died, in particular in the war? And this is this gives a particular word, in fact, because we have this word in English, remembrance, which is a very strange word, and really we only use it to talk about commemorating the First World War and the Second World War. That's all. For any other activity, we say commemoration. But for this one, we call Remembrance, and there is Remembrance Sunday in November every year. So we've actually invented a word specially for the two world wars, which is a sign, perhaps, of the deep mark in the collective psyche. Yeah? So all this side of it. And this is a tremendous point of interest for historians. I went to a conference in Rennes last June, which was called Mémoire de Guerre, and which the entire thing was about remembering and commemorating not just the First World War, but any war. So that's it really is a key theme. The politics of war memory and commemoration. Now, sometimes this theme is criticised because some historians say, well, yeah, we're not talking about the war anymore. We're talking about what people thought about the war later. So that can be an advantage or a disadvantage depending on your point of view. Many people, especially British, American, Australian and Canadian people, like to come to France to visit the battlefields. And this is something very, very particular, cultural activity, that's for sure. Very popular cultural activity. The Prime Minister of Britain said last year, at the beginning of 2014, he said, in the next 4 years, every school child should have the possibility to go and visit the battlefields in France. Every school child in Britain. Now, he didn't ask whether every school child in Britain wanted to. But obviously it had some political and cultural importance if he officially said every school child must have the possibility to go to visit the battlefields in France. It does have a slightly bizarre side to it, you know, because one of the things about battlefields is there's actually nothing there. You know, I mean, I can imagine somebody saying, yeah, every school child should have the chance to go to Rome. Yeah? Because Rome is, you know, you can see it, we've got a battlefield. Any old field, yeah, it's slightly strange, but there you go. Now, debate goes on about cultural history, and this debate is all the more complex because nobody is exactly sure of what the line is around cultural history. But certainly, its strong points are recognised to be, first of all, a concentration on people's lived experience. That is, if you study food, you study about what did food mean to people. If you study conscription, you also study what did it mean to people of the time to join the army. I mean, were they happy, disappointed, proud? And secondly, it's clear that it has led to a widening of the historical object. That is, you know, it's a new idea to say, oh, yeah, food, you can write a history book about food. And this has, not just in the First World War, this has gone on to other periods as well. There's a very, very well-known book called Cod. Cod, what is it? It's a fish. What is it in French, the cod? Cabillaud. It's just a book, the title is Cod. Because the history of the fishing for cod and eating cod is very important. In fact, it's really changed society. There's another book called Salt. So this is an approach of cultural history. Allows you to look at human history from particular points of view, which can be very interesting. However, cultural history has been criticised And one of the main criticisms that has been given is that if you just look at people and their culture, you can forget the important role of governments, trade unions, voluntary organisations, schools, the army, and you just have people and culture, and you may be missing something. That's what some people say. So it's a danger. It's not a condemnation. It's a danger. And along the same lines, it has been said that sometimes cultural history can suggest that everybody in a nation has the same culture, whether they are men or women or working class or elite and so on. So there's obviously a fairly semi-permanent danger here. And so our questions about cultural history that we need to think about: is cultural history only concerned with what people have in their head? There are representations of the world. And secondly, where does people's culture come from? Because it may be that it's not enough to study what people's culture is. You have to decide, where did they get these representations? People have a representation of terrorism or paella, but it comes from somewhere. And then at the end, however, it's certainly true even today that what do social and cultural historians have in common? And this is an interest in history from below, in studying what ordinary people's lives are like. So this brings up, I'm coming to the end of the whole story, having looked at military and political history, social history and cultural history, and it leaves us with questions: what should the priorities be? What priorities should historians choose? I don't know why I wrote this in French when the rest is in English, but sometimes I forget. And this is not a moral imperative. That is, that it's perfectly possible to believe that it's a good thing that historians do not all have the same priority. Well, we need a variety of priorities. But the question has to be asked. And I just want to end with a couple of new ideas in the history of the First World War. This one, for example: the First World War in 100 Objects. This is a history book as a catalogue. There are 100 objects, and each one has 3 or 4 pages about its role in the war. So this is a new approach to writing history books. It reminds us of something very important, and that is, a historian is not just someone who discovers truths which they hope are important about the past. It's also somebody who recounts those. So there's always an audience for a historian. So if you write a fabulously objective and insightful history book which nobody wants to read because it's badly written, then you're not having a lot of effect as a historian. And so the historian is not just a researcher, but it's a researcher and storyteller. The telling is important, and that we're seeing very much these days, because today, of course, many people get their history through television, the History Channel, or documentaries on other things. These documentaries can be very good or very bad, and there may be dangers of making it more sensational, because you have to sell your television program. It costs a lot of money to make a television program, more than to write a book. So then you have to sell it, so maybe it should be more spectacular, sensational. So there are dangers, but also you can get out to a very large number of people. Although probably people learn even more history, good or bad, from Downton Abbey and such things. Yeah, that's what people like them. And sometimes they can be good. I just finished reading Ken Follett's book, The Edge of Eternity. It's a trilogy called The Century. La Chute des Géants, L'Hiver du Monde, La Fin de l'Éternité. Three history novels, but very much about key historical events of the 20th century. You can learn a lot of history from novels sometimes. These are some recent ones. This is the one we're going to look at in a moment. Just a little... And just to end then, this is what's happening in Britain today. This is a list of doctoral theses defended in British universities since 2000. Now, these figures are 2 years old. I have updated them. There are 103. Between 2000 and 2014, there are 103 doctoral theses in Britain with First World War somewhere in the description. And so you can see what's happening here. First of all, military and military history is doing fine. Yeah? In this at this point, 16.5%. So military historians are often worried that it's disappearing. It's not disappearing. Diplomacy not so popular these days. Social and political quite big, and a particular rise in medical history. Six theses out of 100. No, six theses out of 85. It's quite a lot for medical history, I think. And cultural history still winning, still very much winning, and including a lot on women's writing. Six theses on women's writing. Six out of 85 at this point. That's quite a lot, I think. Just about writing, literature, short stories and so on. And look at the last one, commemoration. 11 on commemoration is still a big winner. Now, these are theses collected from many different universities. There's no real specialization in one university or another. And that's like the state of play today. But there will probably still be lots of new ideas over the next 10 or 20 years. A lot of people are doing doctoral theses on the First World War now because of the centenary, which is also because there's more money available because of the centenary. Sometimes when you want to do a doctoral thesis, you need a bit of money. And if you choose to write about the First World War at the moment, the Centenary Fund has money for you. So there's all sorts of things like that going on as well. Okay, next week we're going to look at, first of all, the document which I gave you.